So it begins with dukkha, usually translated in English as suffering, stress, anguish, despair, distress. Some people prefer not to translate it at all, just leave it as dukkha. Kind of a powerful word for Buddhists, kind of laying at the heart of the whole Buddhist faith is understanding and encounter and meeting with dukkha. When I practiced in Thailand at you were given sometimes little kutis, little huts in the jungle woods to practice in, and there were geckos that lived in the little kutis. They'd live in the ceiling above you or in the walls, and they would speak a lot. And mostly what they said was dukkha, dukkha. Reminding us. And this theme for this retreat, the transcendent or liberative dependent origination, begins with dukkha. And one of the important things about this kind of approach to understanding practice is the idea that these are conditions that set in place the next factor along the way, but only when the first factor is well established. And you might already think that you have the dukkha thing well established. You don't need to do anything more about that. You're ready to move on. But dukkha, I remember Ajahn Jumyan coming to Spirit Rock once, and I think he came to the Spirit Rock Teacher Council, and he was talking with tremendous happiness, glee, delight about dukkha. Noble dukkha. So to enter into the world of dukkha well, to have a deep respect for it, maybe even a kind of reverence for it, appreciation for it, and particularly to have a willingness to suffer, willingness to have dukkha. Not to look for it, not to make it, not to glorify it as something supposed to, the more suffering you have, the better. I'm a Buddhist, so I know how to suffer. But see dukkha as a door, as a gateway to that which lies beyond dukkha. Dukkha is the, it's kind of like when you have suffering, it's kind of like someone's there on the other side of the door knocking, hey you, open up for me, or open that door, come through here, here you, this way. Over here. Do I have to be even stronger so you notice me? Over here. Dukkha. And then in that process, it's very important to become aware of how you relate to dukkha, how you relate to your distress, stress, discomfort, anxiety, difficulties. What is your reaction? What is your relationship to it? What's your relationship when you have a lot of wisdom? What's the relationship when you have no wisdom? What are your preferred strategies in relationship to it? Do you get angry? Do you have aversion, hostility to the dukkha or to something else? Is there fear? Is there sadness? Do you take it as, do you use it as a foundation for a worldview? Some idea of the nature of reality because you experience suffering? Or the nature of yourself? Some people have the idea if they suffer, it must be because they're failing. It's rather an embarrassment to suffer. If you were a decent human being, you'd have figured it out long ago, and you simply wouldn't suffer. And better not to let anybody else know, and let them in on the secret. Is dukkha proof to a philosophy that the world is hopeless, or the world is dangerous, or the world is somehow a bad place, or proof that some, you know, what do you make meaning out of? What do you do with it when it appears? What reactions do you have? What relationships do you have to it? What beliefs do you have to it? Because all those things can be extra. All those things kind of muddy the water for you. And you know something about dukkha, suffering? It's really ordinary. It's super ordinary thing to suffer. It's like going to sleep, waking up, washing your face, brushing your teeth, having breakfast, peeing. All these ordinary things that we do. It's so ordinary, it's so common. Human beings on this planet have dukkha. And what happens if you see it as ordinary? It's ordinary to suffer. Just this is what comes with the territory, it's what it is. Not embarrassing, it's not terrible, though it's painful. Just what is. And so this first first step is to kind of somehow come to terms with dukkha, to see it, to understand it, to understand how it is for you, what your relationship is to it, to dukkha, to suffering. To turn towards it rather than run away from it. To turn towards it to as a first step, not as the last step, but as a first step, to somehow hold it lightly, somehow hold it with care, somehow hold it with attention and seeing it what it is. And it's kind of synonymous many times to holding yourself with respect and care, holding yourself with compassion for the suffering that's there, suffering you have, that you're important. Your suffering is important. And so it means that to take time. Take time with your suffering, take time with yourself, and not to be in a hurry, looking at your watch. I've now done 3 sittings on this first day of the retreat, and it should be over. It shouldn't be getting worse. Maybe I'll switch my meditation practice to something else. Maybe something else will work to get rid of it. To be focused on trying to get rid of your suffering as the first strategy, as the frontal attack, usually doesn't work. I think what works much better is to have respect for it, to be curious about it, be curious about yourself in relationship to it. What is this thing? To turn towards it. I'm very fond of a particular prompt that some yoga teachers give when you do yoga. And they, I don't know if it works for you, but it works for me very nicely. They say, let your muscles fall away from your bones. I think it's a great idea. Just like your muscles fall away. Like for me, it's just like I get to be kind of bigger. It's like things just fall outwards in all directions. It's kind of like I fall into my skin. Like the skin's like a sack that holds me, everything together. And so I kind of like fall into that support. Ah, that's holding me. And so to kind of go into your body, into yourself, and just kind of let it kind of just release the holding, release the tightness, the contraction. So is suffering. Not that the suffering goes away, but to go into it and let it release. Let it kind of relax. Let the suffering feel safe. Safe from yourself. It's okay. Let the suffering just kind of, so you have to go into it or feel it or be with it or something and just let it kind of just settle back. Not be hyped up or... So one of the surprises for me in, when I started doing a lot of practice, meditation practice, retreat practice, was how subtle dukkha is. And... you know, when I was practicing my long retreat in Burma, at some point, I took a while, but at some point I had a lot of strong, mindfulness was very strong, and concentration was strong, and I had a lot of joy in the practice, very still in the mind. And then one day I was kind of blown away by a sudden flash of insight. That, well, actually maybe it was two insights. The first was I noticed that any thinking that I had had a certain, even if it's thinking about something very nice, pleasant to think about, that the act of thinking itself had a certain stressful element to it, had a certain sort of suffering involved, even just to think. And then the next flash was, wow. There is a lot of suffering in this world. If this is true for everyone, even how they think, there's suffering. And boy, I mean, there's big suffering, I knew, but if it's this pervasive and deeply embedded in our kind of how we operate, I was kind of like, you know, kind of stunned me to understand how much suffering there is. And it was kind of mind-stopping to this world that we live in. But what was kind of the juxtaposition was I had so much joy in the practice at that moment. And somehow the insight into suffering, this particular insight, was held by a certain kind of contentment, certain kind of joy or sense of well-being. So I wasn't troubled by the insight. It wasn't like overwhelmed or anguished by it. But it was a poignant time. The Buddha gives this wonderful teaching where it talks about himself and practicing, and he realizes, he kind of analyzes or looks at his thinking, and he realizes that certain thoughts are unskillful. So when he has greedy thoughts or hateful thoughts or deluded thoughts, they come with suffering. And so, you know, in a matter-of-fact way, he just put those aside. Very nice. I don't know, maybe it wasn't that easy for him, but... And then he was left with wholesome thoughts, skillful thoughts. And he thought to himself, well, these don't cause me any harm. It's okay to have these. However, if I continue to have these thoughts, it's going to tire me out. And so then he said, okay, let's put these aside as well. And so to begin understanding our thinking... To begin to, not just to understand what we're thinking about, but to understand what is this nature of thinking that we do? What does it feel like? Imagine that you have your thoughts, say if you think in words, but you had you didn't speak the language that those words were happening in. What does it feel like to listen to those thoughts? With the tone of them, are they... The effort to make them, they just float by like gentle clouds sometimes, or is there something little bit off or stressful or to have them? Or when you are aware of the content, How many times are you going to think the same thing? I read somewhere that it was studied out of Americans, apparently, I guess people in the United States. And it said that the average person in the United States spends 85% of their waking time in fantasy. And I was really surprised by that number because I thought it was kind of low. So there's also, you know, there's understanding the dukkha of thinking itself. It's also understanding that unsatisfactoriness of all this thinking and repetition. And there's a really healthy way, very skillful way. It has to be done just right. Just, you have to be kind of, you know, really wise in how you do this. Brilliant way of being sick and tired of your thinking. Just enough already. Not that you can stop it, not that you can then just turn it off. But what it means is that you start becoming less interested in it. And this idea of no longer being interested in your thoughts is a brilliant move. Because as long as you're interested, you'll go there. It'll seem important. And we can invest a lot of authority in our thoughts. I think it seems so important to think what we do, what we think about. It's going to solve, you know, create world peace or personal peace or who knows what your thoughts are about. But they can have a tremendous pull. And so this approach of being curious and interested and respectful of everything, being respectful of our thinking. What is this? What's going on here? Is it really helpful for me to be involved in these thoughts? Is it really supportive? Is it? What is my relationship to it? Am I really interested? Am I fascinated? Do I invest a lot of importance in them? Do I expect to solve all kinds of problems through them? Do I take refuge in the pleasure of the thoughts? The comfort, are they comforting? And so there I go into the thoughts because they're comforting. What's the relationship to it? And is there a healthy way of becoming disenchanted with the activity of thinking? Disenchanted not with aversion, not with discouragement, not with distress or hostility, and not with the expectation that just like that you can stop thinking. But is there kind of a very healthy disenchantment, no longer enchanted by these kinds of the thoughts you have? And to what degree does the suffering you have come from how you think, come from your thinking? What's the role thinking has with suffering? Can you suffer without having thoughts? Does the thoughts somehow fuel the emotions and feelings that you have connected to suffering? And then there's a few places in the suttas where when I first saw this, I was kind of a little stumped. It's in the Dhammapada, so when I came to translate this part, I was kind of like, what? And there's the expression, being disenchanted with suffering. I kind of didn't think anybody was ever enchanted with suffering. Disenchanted with suffering. But I wonder sometimes what kind of enchantment, what kind of trance, what kind of unnecessary preoccupation, what kind of investment of importance, investment of identity, building identity around suffering. What's our relationship to suffering? And is there a healthy, good way of being disenchanted with it? Disenchanted in such a way that we kind of relax around the suffering, relax with the suffering. It's ordinary. The sufferer is ordinary. and a willingness to be ordinary here. So what I've, some of the things I've said so far is, has to do with your relationship to dukkha, how we relate to it, and that it's dukkha is it's very wise to turn towards it, to get to know it well. And I've known people who have been, in some points of view, fairly good at meditation. They can get concentrated well, and have bypassed this foundation of the path to liberation. They've avoided, they used meditation, used concentration to avoid a really respectful willingness to sit and get composed, become still in the middle of their suffering, to really be honest about it. And there was someone here at a retreat this last year that had a very good concentration level for years and years. It didn't take much conversation with this person to understand the person had been avoiding something for years. It's kind of actually kind of not connected so well with what was really going on here. And so the first foundation of this transcendent dependent origination is dukkha, honest, willing to be here for it when it's here. And I'd recommend you don't go looking for it based on this talk. But if it's here, it's here. And guess where mindfulness practice occurs? It's here. So if that's what's here, it's a door. It's okay. It's okay to suffer here. So to open to it, to be present for it. And one of the things that's important about dukkha is that it's the foundation for the second factor in transcendent liberation, and that is faith, or sada, trust or confidence. And it's kind of like what it helps at some point when we have the ability to sit quiet enough and still enough and just be here with this just enough, that we see that there's often we're at a fork. And we have a fork, we can go down two different roads. We can go down the road of suffering more or getting more attached, more clinging, greed, hate, and delusion. Or we can go down the road of freedom from suffering. We can go down the road of towards freedom. We can go down the road of generosity or kindness or compassion or a simple, straightforward mindfulness of what is. And it depends, practice depends a lot on which of these roads we take. And to know that there's a road, different roads, and to know that there is a fork that leads to liberation, and to have faith in it, is fundamental for people who want to travel that road. If you don't know about the road, then you won't even have any faith in it, to have confidence in it. So this idea of liberation lies kind of, very intimately connected to this whole transcendent dependent origination. And I'd like to suggest that for each of you, that even though you might not know it, or thought about it this way, that there's probably some experience you've had in your life that is pretty close to liberation. Some experience of freedom from being caught in your desires, caught in your aversions, your fears, some experience of being freed from self-preoccupation, from defining yourself in ways, some kind of peace or clarity or openness, settledness, some feeling of being at home here in this world. And maybe it's not a strong experience, maybe it's more intuition of it. But if there is some sense, it can be useful, it can actually be nourishing or kind of help you have faith and to know this is possible. Or if you don't have it, maybe you've been around someone who somehow the way they seem to be in the world seem to exude or manifest some kind of way of being free, being at ease or being at peace that was very meaningful for you. But I would encourage you to see if you can find something yourself that's a reference for this. And I know for myself, for many years, one of my default operating systems for when I was young was the grass is always greener somewhere else. It was even worse. It was, if it's happening to me, it's not right. If it's happening to me, it's not the real thing. If it's happening to me, something is, you know, it must be wrong. And that's a really great orientation and interpretation for more suffering. And I was really good at it. And I could have all kinds of, even like remember sometimes my meditation having, you know, good things happening to me, nice, settled, peaceful states. And there was this, you know, yes, and you know, it's not really the real thing. This is not it. There's something else which is it. Maybe in the other side of the meditation hall. Maybe it's over there. It's more dukkha to have those to make. Again, it says it's meaning-making mind. We make meaning out of things. We interpret things, and then so much suffering can come from interpretations and meaning. What this means, you know, it's not right. It's not what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be something else. And even worse about it for me was I was pretty convinced whatever was happening to me was not it. But I had no idea what it was. So, you know, it was kind of like a hopeless thing, right? I wouldn't even know it if I had it. Because I didn't know, you know, whatever it was at any time. So maybe if you're at all like I was, give yourself a break a little bit, and why don't you just assume that some of the things that have happened to you are good, are right. Maybe at that moment they are perfect. Maybe from the things that happened to you on this retreat, just the moment they happened, that's perfect. It couldn't be designed for higher perfection at that moment, whatever experience you have. Just to say it is what it is, to be simple with it, just this. But do you have a reference point for freedom, for liberation, for peace, for purity, for cleanliness, deep ease, to have your heart at home in itself? And so to have faith and confidence that there is a valuable way of being that can be somehow characterized by freedom. And so, in a sense, the path begins with faith. But they say that the path begins with suffering. But I think the path only begins with suffering if you have faith that suffering is the beginning. So that's, you know, so anyways, and it all gets confused, right? Which one is the first? But you know, to be willing to suffer, to willing to turn towards it in this respectful way, careful way that I'm talking about, and be willing to kind of step into it, to find the door, to find the ease, to find the relaxing with it, to find just being mindful with it, just this. And so to have faith and confidence in yourself, to have confidence that you have the capacity to be present with your experience. You have the capacity to meet the experience that's here. You have the capacity to be simple to be ordinary with this. I mean, a lot of what we're looking for here, I think, is really to be ordinary. I like the word ordinary a lot. But not, you know, I kind of, you know, mostly we're not ordinary. We're struggling and trying to be different than how things are, and, you know, trying to get rid of things and fix things. And ordinary means somehow just to be okay, to be at peace. It's okay. Just to be present. And, you know, mindfulness is meant to be just so simple. Kind of like just an ordinary thing, just to be present for this. But not to make more of it than what it is. Just to be here, present. So to have faith in your capacity to practice, to engage, to do it. And I would say that one of the really life-changing aspects of this practice for me is the confidence and the trust that I have in the practice itself. That if I practice mindfulness, if I show up and just stay with experience and come back to the moment, come back to here, and in a very simple, direct way, just moment by moment, best I can, come back. And I don't have to even be good at it. And sometimes I think it's best to try not to be too good at doing the practice. Because it's kind of like running a marathon. Sometimes you do better, you know, with a marathon. I don't know what, you know, running 60% of full capacity, not 100%. I think meditation too, if you try to do meditation 100% well, you probably do it, for most circumstances, you probably do it poorly. You know, it's okay to do it 60%. Mind wanders off, come back, it's okay. Maybe that's how it goes fastest. But with sincerity, with faith, to kind of engage in the practice. And I've learned over and over and over again that something begins to happen. Something changes, something loosens up, something frees, something opens up in this experience of this life. And that's one of the things I now kind of trust with my life, that if I can be mindful of what's happening, then the whole situation becomes trustable. If I can be mindful, if I can't be mindful of it, then I don't know, then I'm not really on top of it. Maybe it's not so safe, I have to be careful. But if I can really be mindful, present with what's happening, so that's one of the trusts, the confidences that I've learned from this practice. And so this is one of the reasons why I've learned that it's okay to suffer. Because then I can bring the practice to it, the mindfulness and attention to it. And things change. What's nice about this change, I think, is that, and why trust is such a good word for this, is that I can't orchestrate the change. I don't feel like I'm in charge. I'm in charge of the condition of being present, coming back. But some of the kind of the more transformative changes that happen in the practice, the way it unfolds and changes over time, over the sitting, over the day of practice, it's not something that I feel like I do. And for a long time, one of my sufferings on practicing was being the one who had to do it, the one who had to try and fix and adjust and get rid of. And so to have faith in the practice. And to have faith in the community you practice with, to trust. It's quite a phenomenal thing to practice with another group of people. And I know that that also I was slow to come to appreciate. It was only retrospectively that in my years of practice that I look back and understand that I could not have practiced as much and as well as I happen to do without the support of others, without the example of others practicing, without kind of feel like we're doing it kind of on the path together. And I came to have a lot of confidence and trust in the community of people that I practice with, some people further along the road than me, some people behind, some people next to me. It's a great thing to have that. So these three, you know, these are kind of gone over three kinds of confidence and trust or faith. in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, the Buddha is awakening or freedom. The Dharma is very much to do with the practice, Sangha, and the community. And, you know, and a very important part of this faith is to have confidence and faith in yourself. There's one place in the suttas where the Buddha talks about a fourth refuge. And there's Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the three. And then just near a time when he was going to die, he said, make yourself a refuge. Be a refuge unto yourself. And I think it's wonderful. And then he said, how do you make a refuge unto yourself? How do you make yourself a refuge? And he said, I practice mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind states, mindfulness of the dhammas. That's how you make a refuge to yourself. So in a way, it comes back to the practice. You are the practice. The practice is not apart from you. You are the Dharma in a certain way. And the awakening should be yours. So to have faith in yourself, to have confidence, to have faith that it's okay to be who you are, to have confidence that it's okay to show up as you are. And that's why I like very much of these two factors, suffering and faith, come one after the other. They're next to each other. They're holding hands. It's nice to think of them as holding hands. Because when you're suffering, when you feel stress, unease, and then to combine that with trust, with confidence, with faith, that it's okay to be who you are. It's okay to be this person at this moment. It doesn't mean that you're condoning it. It doesn't mean that you're celebrating this is good. But it also doesn't mean that you have to condemn it. You have faith it's okay in the practice of showing up and being who you are. And I think it's one of the gifts of this practice is you get to be yourself. You really get to be yourself, and you know, so you kind of relax and let the muscles fall away from your bones, relax into your skin. Just be as you are, but then wake up. Wake up to who you are. Wake up to what's happening. Be present for it. Be here to experience it. Recognize what it is. See it for what it is. Acknowledge it for what it is. Occasionally, when my concentration is strong and my mind is still, I've had a kind of a very fascinating experience. It's kind of been, in some ways, a very powerful lesson. And that is that, you know, there can be occasionally very little thought going on. A lot of quiet, a lot of space between the thoughts I might have. Very still. And then I'm just kind of right there, being present. There's not much going on. and I can be aware, then I'm beginning to think. And for me that comes with, maybe it's almost a physical, visual sense, that's kind of like the surface of a water, and a bubble starts to come up from below the water and begins to break the surface of the water, and the bubble kind of rises up, and it's going to rise up maybe and float up into the air. And so I start to feel or sense or see or something like this bubble breaking up, coming up out of the surface of the water. And that's the beginning of the thought. But if my mind is mindful enough at that moment and see it as it begins, then that bubble just dissolves back into the water. Dissolves back into the mind or whatever goes on. Now it's pretty fascinating that sometimes occasionally the mind can see that well, because you're so present, fully here for the experience. But what I find more fascinating is that that thought disappears without me ever knowing what the thought was. Now, you know, I could be distressed. It could have been the solution to all my problems, the great American novel. You know, who knows? I mean, but the track record of it, you know, it doesn't really. You shouldn't put your bets on that, on those thoughts. The next one's going to be the one. So, but you don't. You know, so the idea is, I don't know what it just. So then the question is, where do those thoughts begin? Where do they come from? You know, where the impulse, the motivation to have those thoughts? If I didn't do it, if I wasn't, you know, thinking them myself, and I who am I after all? And I usually think that, you know, well, I'm somehow connected to the conscious part of me. The part that, like, you know, that which is thinking, and I know that I'm thinking and knowing, and that part that knows, but if something happens offline, below the level of consciousness and knowing, if that's where thoughts begin, who's down there? Who's making those thoughts? And you know, it's just fascinating, you know, to kind of sit there and get just be quiet, like just sit, watch the arising of phenomena, the arising of a thought. Where did it come from? And now it's here. And to be at that place where you're there present, and you're really going to stay and watch the appearance of a sound. There's a sound in the room or outside. And not just so much a sound is interesting, but the fact that you are there and you see it arise in the mind. To have a body sensation that wasn't there before, but see it arise. It's kind of like a miracle, the occurrence of something, the arising of something. What's this? But this arising of thought, this arising of awareness itself. Have you ever had the experience of, you know, on retreat, maybe trying to be mindful, trying to be present, and drift off, come back, drift off, come back. And then you just kind of like find yourself aware? I hope that's happened to you. I hope it's not too weird. It's like, what? Now I'm here. And it generally happens a lot more often than you realize, because generally if we wander off in thought and lost in thought, at some point you know that's the case. And that knowing that's the case probably happened pretty effortlessly. Where did that come from? There's something here that knows, something here that is the other thing I noticed about when I'm right there watching the arising of a thought, when it just begins, even if I arise, it might not disappear, it might come up right there, that it seems like that's a state that to be trusted. That's a place that where I can trust my response, my reaction, what's going on to the world. I'm not so likely to act from greed, hate, and delusion when I'm right there watching the beginning of things, watching the start of it. If I'm there for the manifesting of awareness, the arising of awareness, if I allow myself to be present, if I allow for awareness and mindfulness to arise, Where does mindfulness begin? Does it always have to be something that you do? The conscious part of you, the one who thinks they're in charge, the control tower, the one who tries to accomplish something? Or is there another approach to being mindful, to being aware, to being present, that maybe is more of a allowing something to arise, allowing awareness, knowing, mindfulness to happen? Because the mind will know. The mind will be mindful, will be attentive. It's very hard to turn that part off if you kind of get out of the way for it. So part of the motivation for me to say all this about the arising of thoughts and seeing it before it becomes clear what it is and it goes away and the arising of things is to see if maybe by saying these things I could a little bit encourage you to get fascinated, interested, curious at what is your experience? What is this experience of being a person at this moment? What's happening here? So that as you, sooner or later, maybe later rather than sooner, start becoming disinterested and disenchanted in your thoughts. When you no longer invest a lot of importance in your suffering, when you're no longer caught up in expectations and wanting things to be a certain way or trying to make something happen, that you have an alternative, and that alternative is to just be really here for this experience, curious. What is this? Amazing experience of this moment of being a living person, being alive. 5 billion years of evolution has come to this sensation, this thought, this feeling. There's something really amazing going on here that is a little bit maybe beyond even your conscious thought, just like having those thoughts begin outside of conscious thought. And to kind of really be here and feel into this moment and the depth of it, the fullness of it, to trust it, to have faith in it, even if you're suffering. To relax, to let the muscles fall away from the bone, to have your brain relax out into its skull. To kind of relax into a quiet that allows you to be, to allows the manifestation that this world to show itself to you, to sparkle, to be here. So as you get disenchanted, perhaps you'll have delight, happiness, joy, stillness, tranquility, greater focus, concentration, and in time to see things as they are. So after, so suffering is the first step, it's the door to the path, and then there's faith, trust, confidence, sincerity, respect, generosity, all kinds of words that I think relate to faith as a second step. And then the third step is delight, gladness, and then happiness. So we'll continue the series tomorrow with these happy emotions. So it's a custom here at the end of a talk to regather yourself or come back to your practice. Maybe you have never left it, but come back into the silence.